This is Breaking the Rules, a show for mental health professionals designed to help you build confidence in treating obsessive compulsive disorder. I'm Dr. Celine Gelgich, and I'm a clinical psychologist who works extensively with OCD.
And I'm Dr. Victoria Miller, but you can call me Tori. And I'm a clinical psychologist who works with young people, including those with OCD. Through our shared professional experience, we've found that effective treatment of OCD requires commitment, creativity, and the recognition that things can sometimes get a little messy.
They sure can. We want to empower clinicians to be able to work with their patients in new ways to treat OCD with confidence. Welcome back to the next episode of Breaking the Rules. Today, we are speaking to George Habib about towing the line between structured treatment protocols and when to explore other influences and triggers of OCD that can get in the way of treatment. George Habib is a clinical psychologist and is the Associate Director of Wellbeing Services at the University of Melbourne. Alongside this role, he has been working in his own clinical practice for over 25 years. Over the years, George has held clinical leadership roles within government, health services, and the NGO sector. Currently, he is a non-executive board member of the Victorian Legal Aid and chair of VLA's Workplace Wellbeing and Health and Safety Committee. He was also a member of the Victorian Government's Therapeutic Treatment Board. George has an interest in the meaning of symptoms, working with patients who have experienced traumatic events, and clinical supervision.
In today's episode, you'll hear a bit of a change of pace because we have a bit of a fireside chat with George about the art of therapy. We explore what lies beneath OCD, how we marry the use of structure as offered by ERP as a treatment, while also leaving room for exploration when needing to address other hurdles. Do we use one modality over another? Do we make room for both? I think you're going to enjoy this experience. Let's get started.
Welcome to another episode of Breaking the Rules podcast. Today we have the wonderful George Habib joining us to talk about what lies beneath that mountain of OCD. It kind of feeds off this idea that we can get stuck in treatment at times and we have questions and all this sort of stuff might come up and we might take it to supervision, we might consult with a peer, we might do some reading and all that sort of stuff. And we thought, well, Tori and I agree that George is the master of helping us understand and unpack things, working with both of us over a long period of time. So we thought, why not invite him along to join us and help share some of his words of wisdom to help us do that.
We always kick off, George, by just helping get our listeners get to know you a little better. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey into psychology, how you found your way here?
I was one of those late arrivals, really. Not late, but I came to psychology through my own psychoanalysis, really. So the start of my story was that I entered into therapy, and initially at that time I was an economist, actually, and studied economics and realised that was a bit soul-destroying for me, maybe not for others, and entered into analysis and then started to work in welfare. And I guess, you know, the influence of my therapy really influenced my interest in starting to do the work myself. And from that, I went back as a mature age, like a young mature age. I wasn't an old mature age, but I was mature enough, you know, the one that puts his hand up and talks too much in class, and the 18-year-olds are going, oh, well, he should shut up. And, you know, it's one of those. I was definitely one of those.
Get your assignments done ahead of time.
Oh, absolutely. H1s all the way, mm-hmm. you know, like.
And secretly, those 18-year-olds were jealous.
Yeah, but they were having more fun than me. And then from there, just started to work in public work, did a whole range of various like work as a psychologist, kind of worked a lot in the trauma field. One of the first males who worked in a sexual assault service, you know, worked and consulted to child protection, but also had set up my private practice pretty early part-time. And so kind of have just really continued there, and I've kind of mixed my work now, you know, like I don't do a lot. I mean, I do a lot of clinical work. I do probably about 15 hours a week. I run a whole bunch of programs in the university. I lecture, I sit on boards, you know, like got to be careful when I say that, but it's one of those like people who gets to just choose and pick what I want to do, really, which I'm very privileged in that way. My interest has always been around trying to understand the symptom in context rather than just the pathology of or fixing the symptom. And probably that was because I don't know whether my analysis cured me of my symptoms. I just think I've put them to work more.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a really important concept just generally as practitioners, but I think bringing it back to the OCD space specifically, I think it is a really, really easy trap to fall into to be symptom focused, especially when we're using modalities like ERP, which is so behaviorally driven in many ways. It's very, very easy, I think, to become preoccupied with the presentation of OCD and the skills to reduce that symptomatology rather than seeing and engaging with the person, with their story, with their context. I think that some of these modalities, I think, lure us away from the broader story and towards that focus. I think we've got to work quite hard as practitioners to stay connected to the bigger picture and to sort of, and to maintain that sense of curiosity.
Yeah, I think we forget that there's a person there still and they do function in a bigger system. And like we talked about in a previous episode, Tori, you put it really in a really lovely way, you've got to step off the garden path sometimes and explore that garden in order to understand that bigger picture, but also help the person put together all the different pieces of themselves, not just those symptoms. And so it comes back to this idea of form and function. You know, we can see what OCD looks like, and yes, to a degree, we might want to relieve some symptoms and get some level of functionality back. But as we've noticed time and time again with clients, that only gets us to a certain point. And then we get stuck because there's so many other things happening for that client.
Yeah.
So how do we do that?
Well, as you were both talking, what I was thinking about is it's not an either or, right? And that's the thing that we can get caught up in, that either we're working on symptom reduction or we're working existentially meaning making, for example, or hopefully maybe breaking down meaning, because sometimes our clients are too full of meaning. I am this, I am that. There's a rigidity of identity, for example, that can also get in the way. I don't see them as separate. In other words, I think there's absolutely a place, and maybe I know Celine would know this, is my terminology, and this is just in my own headspace and it won't be necessarily what the evidence base completely says, but I see the difference between structured psychological treatment and psychotherapy. But actually, when you look at the research into psychotherapy generally, let alone in terms of specific kind of treatments for specific kind of diagnoses, that actually that psychotherapy and structured psychological treatment are kind of combined in a way, right? So, you know, one of my idols theoretically is Wompold, Bruce Wompold. You know, he developed a pan-theoretical model around, called it the contextual model of psychotherapy. And he wouldn't discount in any way that we have to have structured treatment for OCD. And in fact, for our clients, sometimes the symptom reduction and knowing that there can be symptom reduction can allow an opening for being able to think more fully about why are these symptoms in my life in the first place. So you need to have both. Like, I think about that for, you know, like my area of expertise is, say, PTSD, right? And I would say that my preference often there is to try a frontline treatment, starting with that and then seeing where the residual is, what else or what emerges, because things will emerge through the structured treatment anyway, which will signpost what else is required or what else can be explored in the treatment. And how do we provide that explanation to the clients that we work with and co-construct the kind of treatment we're engaging with? Because co-construction of therapy is actually a really significant factor in outcomes. I gather there's a whole bunch that we can talk about here around that, but I think that it is it's not an either or, it's a both and.
I've been listening to some interesting things lately in relation to what you're talking about, George, about the place for psychoanalytic psychotherapy in the treatment of OCD, which has long been thought of as contraindicated in the treatment of OCD because people become too fixated on finding meaning in their intrusive thoughts and they become compulsively ruminate. And I've been doing some listening and reading about the place of both ERP and psychoanalytic psychotherapy, you know, that it doesn't have to be either or. But yeah, as you say, that sometimes we have to reduce the symptomatology first in order to create a space for some thinking to occur. And I think that that has really resonated me in the recent times. I think I was certainly not psychoanalytic psychotherapy, and I'm not a psychoanalyst. I've not done my training. I'm only just aware of concepts and done some professional development. But I'm certainly very comfortable doing supportive psychotherapy and things like that. But I think it was just this notion that where's the line between what is sort of contraindicated, unhelpful, actually feeding back into OCD versus what is good and nurturing and actually really helpful. And I think that I was becoming perhaps a little bit too
black and white, maybe.
Yeah. You know, the idea of weaving these two together, I think, is a really beautiful concept. And now, more recently, hearing people talk about weaving together psychoanalytic psychotherapy and ERP makes me really curious and really excited that we're not thinking about it in such dichotomous terms anymore, which I really like.
I think it's one of those things that we do have to make room for, because like with anything, if there is so much pain, emotional pain especially, physical pain is the same thing, people become so focused on that, there's no room for anything else. You know, sometimes you can barely even hear what someone is saying to you, let alone what's going on in your own thinking space aside from what's causing pain. And I think once all that settles down, exactly like what you guys have been talking about, there is room for that thinking. And I think if we're aware of ERP as that frontline treatment and what we need to be holding in mind so as we're not kind of feeding back into reassurance loops and all that sort of stuff, but what we can do, and this is where I find myself going in therapy with a lot of my clients, and this is what I bring to supervision, is how can our clients exist with their thoughts that they know cause so much pain and live in that uncertainty without exactly knowing what's going to happen? And I think that's where psychotherapy can really kind of come in and help our clients sit with that discomfort and toe that line of, but what if, you know? And I think that's where it can kind of fit in really in a really lovely way without feeding back into and focusing too much on meaning. Does that make sense?
It's really interesting what's being discussed, because what I was reflecting on was Freud's famous case of the rat man. And this was really, if we used the modern day diagnostic system, we would say that he said that he had an obsessional neurosis, but, you know, he would have had OCD. People don't recognise that even in Freud's case study, he asked him to go to the cemetery to grieve about someone. He would sometimes get him to, you know, set kind of these behavioural challenges around. So this idea that, look, insight is not enough in any treatment. Insight in and of itself, that if, like, and especially for someone who experiences obsessional symptoms, insight without action is really problematic. And I think that, again, that idea that, you know, one only does this, the idea that there's not behavioural change or behavioural challenge or behavioural exposure or exposure in some form that should stem from, you know, a therapeutic encounter, I think is a really problematic idea. Yeah, because, you know, one feeds the other, right? Behavioural change and behavioural experimentation leads to change in thoughts and insight, right? It's not one way and it's not the other. And so, you know, again, I think that we've been caught up in this question of, well, what's the active ingredient of therapy? Well, there's lots of different active ingredients, and of course, within the context of the therapeutic relationship and what it is that allows people to engage in change through that.
One of the things that I suppose, you know, conversations like this generate for me, and I'm not sure that I've completely consolidated what my question is, but I suppose one of the things I'm super curious about is the idea that the development of OCD, our formulation of the function of OCD, is that I think there are different ideas about why people develop OCD, whether it's just it's genetic, whether it's neuroanatomical, neurobiological, whether it is psychological in that it is a response to life events. And I think sometimes the therapies, particularly the more behavioral ones, lead us away from making sense of OCD, which I don't think is particularly useful either. And I think that that's where I think sometimes we as clinicians get a little bit worried about the symbolism perhaps in some of the symptoms, or perhaps the context within which the symptoms emerged and what that might have represented at the time or what might have been happening for a person when these symptoms evolved. I'm not sure that I'm truly aligned with this idea that it's just behavioral, habitual, it's just the limbic system. I think that's too reductionistic. But I don't think that as clinicians, especially when you're taught to use ERP, and I think you do start from just really immersing yourself and it's a very behavioral program, I think it does lose some of its quality in terms of our formulation if we're just looking at it from the perspective of behavior. And I do think that there is something to be learned from wondering about where the OCD came from for this person and what it might represent. But I think we are a little scared to name that or wonder about it, I think, because in some instances that does kind of conflict a little bit with what we say about OCD, which is the non-judgmental stance of our thoughts. Thoughts are just thoughts. They don't mean anything. They come and they go, leaves on a stream, right? But then to have a curious conversation about what this might represent, I mean, walking that line, I think is nuanced and tricky. And I guess I'm curious, George, your thoughts about how we might be curious with our clients about that, how to navigate.
I don't hear it as a question, Tori. I hear it as the dilemmas of therapy.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I think my question then, George, is how do I fix that dilemma?
Yeah.
Well, maybe by, you know, like as we return to the function of the symptom, that there is never a fixity or a certainty.
Mm.
And that's often what's being sought, right? And that's difficult for us as individuals to live with, but also for our patients or our clients, depending on which terminology you prefer to use. I think in a way, you know, as you've both described with the treatment, it would be in looking, for me, it would be around in looking at kind of exploring, for example, the meaning. Like, you know, I still fundamentally, I'm kind of probably a classicist. I still really like to look at the index event. I like to be able to track, so when did this emerge? So what am I doing when I'm asking that question, right? I'm looking for what was going on in a person's life. What was the encounter that they were having with, you know, was it with their, you know, puberty, with family conflict? But again, even when I name these, I don't want to necessarily ascribe to a set meaning making or cause, because, and this is fundamentally my approach, is that we fictionalize our history. And fictionalizing our history is actually a really beautiful human endeavor.
It's adaptive, right?
Yeah, but hopefully that we can fictionalize so much that we don't get caught up in I am this. Because actually for me, that is the most problematic aspect of what I see. You know, there was a massive and continues to be a really significant debate in the psychoanalytic community, not so much now, but between those who believe that the role of psychoanalysis or psychotherapy was strengthening the ego and those who are saying that actually, no, the ego is a problem. I probably am much more of the orientation that the ego is a problem. So it's when a patient who comes to you and it's almost as if they're saying, I am OCD. And how is it that one can, well, not that we can necessarily do this, and I take it from a comfort of having perhaps a sense of my being through time, but how does one wake up in the morning and say, I don't know who I am. I'll become through the day and into the night, and then I'll be someone the next day, right? Now, I don't want to discount that for some people. That is really problematic because literally they lose a sense of a thread between different selves. And we know with OCD that there can be some horrific senses of, am I a pedophile? Am I this? Am I, you know, am I a sex offender? Am I, there's horrific kind of thinking there. But I still think it's really important to think about, whilst the way that the obsessional symptom takes its hold may draw on something, how the obsessionality functions is really important. I don't get caught up in, yes, I think there's undoubtedly a genetic component. We'll never know. Like, I don't care how much people say, we got the marker, we got this, you know, like, we know that actually it's multifactorial and it's particular to each individual. And each individual particularized the meaning of what it's about for them. And the work of therapy is to look at how does one free oneself up from a rigid notion about that? And hopefully symptom relief occurs. I think I've described to Celine before, you know, the way that I think about, say, cognitive behavioral treatment of OCD and, say, more kind of acceptance and commitment treatment, and, you know, there's various different modalities about both those, I see them as Old Testament and New Testament approaches. Old Testament CBT says, you're thinking this way, you shouldn't, we need to get rid of it. New Testament is saying, you know what, you're going to keep on thinking a little bit like this. How do you come to terms a little bit with this, but also make it function? How can you live? So the dilemma that you spoke about, Tori, is a really important one, because perhaps it's in, you know, we're going down a particular path in treatment and we can see the way that the obsessionality can attach to and it's not helpful. And then how do we work with our patients to say, it's okay to say this isn't working, or we need to look at shifting some of this in the way that we're thinking about this? I know you said that I'm a master of something. No, there's no master. In other words, sometimes I'm stumbling along with my patients to try and work through what's going to be working and how can they live and how can they have some enjoyment and pleasure and purpose in their life, which surely should be the most important thing about any therapeutic encounter.
Oh, 100%. Because just by nature of having obsessional thoughts, it's, you know, always this stuckness and this reoccurring thought process and this rigidity around particular styles of thinking. And I think it's important to call that out and say, well, this isn't functional. How is this helpful? What does this mean for you? Where did this, you know, when did you first start experiencing these thoughts? What was going on for you at the time? What does it represent? But at the same time, how can we make room for letting them be while focusing on living life, not just existing in life? Well, that's a tough one, because our clients, as we know, don't feel comfortable in that, because they feel sometimes untethered. Sometimes OCD is just a way to help contain things, or it's a way to get some control back in an otherwise chaotic world or existence, or what it might feel like that. Or it's a way to distract from other things that might be going on, and so on and so forth. And it's different for everybody. You know, I don't think there are two people that would ever present in the same way. You can have 10 different people with contamination type OCD and they'll all wish they had each other's symptoms because it would feel easier. How many times have we said, Tori, you know, especially to our teens in group, be careful what you wish for, because it's all relative. It's a relative experience and it's different for everybody.
And doesn't that kind of describe the wish to be elsewhere? I wish I was there.
Yes, the grass is always greener everywhere, except for your own backyard. Okay. It's just been such a fascinating discussion so far. And I remember, George, when I first came in for supervision with you, you said to me, I don't know if you remember this, do you remember this conversation we had like 4 years ago when I asked you how ERP was going? And this is you saying this to me, and you told me how wonderful it is and how it works and that sort of stuff. And I asked you to let me know how you go with that. Do you remember this conversation?
No. I don't, but I want to know what meaning you derived from.
Yeah, no. Well, first of all, I was like, wow, he's got a great memory. He remembered something from like 4 years ago. We were at a conference, and then I came into supervision and you were like, okay, now we're here to do the thing that I knew you needed to learn, because I was still early in my career, of, you know, ERP only gets you to a certain point, because that's what you had mentioned. You were like, you don't feel like you kind of just get to a certain point and then you don't progress any further. And I was like, nah, it's really great, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, Jesus, I was an arrogant.
No, not at all, not at all. But also ERP, I still do think it is wonderful and it does have such an amazing treatment outcome when people are willing and able to kind of participate, even if it's reluctantly so. But also we do need to fill the rest of the picture with all this stuff that we've been talking about today, because I think it's really important, because people aren't their symptoms, they are people. And I think we can really easily forget that, especially when all three of us supervise. So I know, you know, you might get a supervisee coming in going, there's like 10 different diagnoses here. Where do I start? You know, from borderline to ADHD to whatever else is on the list. And it's just an obvious picture of people just getting stuck in the symptoms. And the first thing I always say is put the paper down. Let's strip it right back. Get to know the person. Forget what's written on the piece of paper, because it can feel really intimidating and scary. And they're like, where do I start? What do I treat first? And it's like, how about we get to know the person first? And this is exactly, I think, what we're talking about here. Don't forget to get to know your client. Okay, so just to wrap it up, George, thank you so much for our really insightful and thought-provoking discussion. We always ask our guests to share an intrusive thought, if they're willing, with us that you might have experienced over the years.
I would say the most intrusive thought, which would probably be very common for the perfectionist clinicians around us, is that I'm fraudulent.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the, we call it imposter syndrome now. There's different ways that it's spoken about, but just the idea, like, oh, if people really only knew. But again, you know, like maybe it's a little bit because of our field. I just don't know anyone who doesn't have that.
Yeah. Me neither.
Neither.
Yeah. But it never ceases to amaze me how lonely people feel, even though we know that everyone kind of gets it, how lonely people feel within that and isolated and like they're the only one. Like it just feels so real and, yeah, to us individually.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like I know that for me, I've thought a lot about in terms of shame, right? So that's a connection. And, you know, I had to deal with a lot of, you know, shame in my therapy around my younger years. And so, you know, there's, again, look at what am I doing? I'm doing what I'm demonstrating, right? What's the meaning of the symptom, right? And here we go. There you go.
And the next episode.
Yeah, so that's one. Yeah.
Oh, and the other question that we always ask our guests, George, is whether there's something you know now that you wish you'd known earlier in your career.
Oh, yeah, for sure. One was to not get caught up in therapeutic modalities in the way that I did when, you know, like I was really probably asshole-ish a bit about, you know, psychoanalysis and, you know, it was everything and it could fix everything and everyone else was dumber than me. And, you know, what I've learned from experience is that actually amongst the profession there is so much rubbish spoken about around this is the best treatment for this, and I don't want to take away from there's a real evidence base for different treatments, but I feel freer as a clinician nowadays that I don't know everything. I'm not going to fix everybody. There's going to be some people that just aren't going to work with my style and my way of working, and I'm okay with that, and I'm okay to call it too. And I don't hold on to patients. Like I used to, you know, think, oh, no, it's not time to drop out, or, you know, you're not ready. And I've kind of shifted a bit because I've seen through time that people just come back, you know, and that you've, and so I assume a lot more competence in who I see now than what I used to. And that's made a big difference in my sense of responsibility in my treatment. I take my work seriously, but everyone's journey is their own.
Yeah. I can relate to what you're saying, because I think something that's really resonated with me in the last few years through my own supervision is just coming back to the idea that in psychology, you're right, we assume a lot of responsibility sometimes, but we are not responsible. But within that, what we provide is a thinking space. And coming back to that grounds me so much.
That's what we paid for.
Yeah, that's right. To think and to wonder together. And that just reminding myself that that is our role, that that is what we do, that is special. Yeah, it really grounds me in the work and lets me let go of some of those pressures and that can be really tied to us in these roles. Thank you, George. Thank you for joining us today. It's so lovely to see you again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure seeing both of you too.
You've been listening to Breaking the Rules, a show for mental health professionals designed to help you build confidence in treating obsessive compulsive disorder.
This podcast is brought to you by Melbourne Wellbeing Group, a psychology practice based in Melbourne with a special focus on treating OCD. To find out more, head to our website, melbournewellbeinggroup.com.au. All one word, that's melbournewellbeinggroup.com.au.
This podcast was made with strategy and production support from Wavelength Creative. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Breaking the Rules, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Celine Galgetch.
And I'm Tori Miller.
And we'll be back next episode with more reasons to convince you to get messy.
Have fun
and break the rules.